The subject is faith.
When you think of faith, what chapter in the Bible, more than almost any other chapter, just kind of stands out?
Hebrews 11.
The great list, category of men and women of faith. And it seems to me that the best definition of walking by faith is found not in the 11th chapter of Hebrews, but in chapter 12 and verse 1. The conclusion of this great category of men and women of faith, with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and Joshua and all of these tremendous men and women of faith who achieved marvelous results by faith. Chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. And I'd like to talk to you tonight about one little phrase out of Hebrews 12, 1, because I think it's probably one of the best definitions or the best bases for talking about being a man or a woman of faith. Therefore, because of Abraham and Moses and Joshua and all of these men and women, therefore, seeing we're compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us. Christ wants you to not only leave the gate Saturday morning with all the sin out of your life, but the weights, the hindrances, the things that aren't sin, but nonetheless are a hindrance, a deterrent to you. There are two things that you need to lay aside. Sin is one of them, and the weights, the entangling alliances and all the rest, things that drag you down, that make you less than being really effective for Christ. The things which do so easily beset us. And let us run with patience the race that is set before us. That's what I want to talk about tonight. Run with patience the race that is set before us. Those three phrases, those three expressions. Running. What does it mean to run? What idea comes to your mind when you think of running? Because running is one of the favorite New Testament expressions describing the Christian life. The first thing that comes to mind is that it's a process rather than a punctiliar or point-in-time experience. Running has the idea of motion, of movement, of direction, of progress, of going from point A to point B. And it isn't something that's over with. It's not just a step. I take a step. That's a moment. But it's a process. It's a period of time. It implies direction and purpose and meaning. There is an objective. There is a point B out there. I started at point A. There is a point B. Now, sometimes you run from point A all the way around back to point A, but even that's an objective. It's to be the first one back to point A. Last week, they had a marathon up Pikes Peak, and they started at the bottom of the hill. I don't know how many people there were, and these men ran to the top of Pikes Peak, and they ran back down to the bottom. I was talking to one of the NAV fellows who participated, and he said, I was still going up, and there were people already coming down. Even so, he came in about 11th or 14th or something out of, I don't know, 70 or 80 men. And that's not, I couldn't walk to the top of Pikes Peak. They'd have to carry me down. Purpose, direction, let us run. And after mentioning faith, 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 over and over and over and over again in Hebrews 11, Then he said, now, therefore, you and I, let's run. Let's run. There's another idea that comes to mind. Not only a process, the second thought that comes to mind is the price. It's costly. It is hard work. There's discipline involved. There is a price to pay. If you and I were all to run out here tonight and say, well, let's have a race, see who can be the first one down to the gatehouse, it wouldn't take us very long to find out who the people are who are in condition. The people who've been running all week, or the joggers, that, you know, species which is about to become extinct around here, according to Russ Reed. We'll find out who the people are who run 2, 3, 4, 5 times a week, and who the non-runners are. Because after a very short time, all of us non-runners are going to be huffing and puffing like the little steam engine. And the other people are just going to be going along here, you know. Not much effort. Maybe a little more up at 6,000 feet. Costly. Discipline. Jot down in your Bible, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, because Paul talks about running and the price that he paid to run. Corinthians 9. Let's start about verse 23. And this I do for the gospel's sake, that I might be partaker thereof with you. Know ye not that they which run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize, first prize? So run that you may obtain. Run to finish. Run to win. And everyone who strives for the masteries is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, a crown of leaves, maybe even a crown of gold. But as Tom mentioned in his testimony, even gold is going to perish someday. But we run for an incorruptible crown. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly. I'm not just kind of running here, running there, and back and forth. No, I'm running in a straight course. I fight, not as a shadow boxer, beating the air. I keep my body under subjection. Discipline. I think the Phillips translation says, so that my body does what it should, not what it wants to do. I keep my body under subjection. I control my body. My body serves me. I do not serve my body. Lest that by any means, after I have finished preaching to other people, I myself should be a castaway. This idea of castaway means disqualified. The referee comes out on the track and says, you, get off the track. You're disqualified. On the shelf. Unfit for further service. Simply waiting for your time to die. Everyone who strives for the mastery is temperate in all things. Discipline. I keep my body under control. Discipline. Running implies a price. There's fatigue when you run. And for you and for me, there are two kinds of obstacles. There's the internal obstacle of fatigue. There's the external obstacle of circumstances. And in running the Christian life, we need to keep both of those things in mind. If you're running a race, cross country, long distance, It may be an obstacle course. There may be external things out there that you have to go over or around. Then there's the internal obstacle of fatigue and tiredness, the emotional drain. And you'll have to keep both of those things in mind. Pace yourself. We'll talk about that in a minute when we come to the subject of patience. Now I'd like to give you another New Testament definition of running. Who can quote? Anybody? Galatians chapter 5 and verse 7. Paul writes to these Christians and said, "Ye did run well, but someone hindered you that you should not what? Obey the truth." In the New Testament, running and obedience are synonymous. And when the author of Hebrews over here says, run with patience the race that is set before us, he's talking about the whole concept of obedience. And in one sense, there are no unimportant decisions in life. I'm not talking about the kind of decisions you wake up in the morning and say, well, should I wear blue socks or brown socks? Not the color of socks type decision. We're not talking about that. Or should I wear a green shirt or a red shirt? No, that's not it. Let's take a look at a man who made some decisions back in Genesis 13, Abraham's nephew. He made some decisions. It's kind of one of these things where he got the wrong button in the wrong buttonhole. He made a series of decisions. He made a bad first decision. Let's take a look at the life of Lot. Genesis 13:10. There had been an argument between the shepherds who took care of Lot's sheep and the shepherds of Abraham. And Abraham the elder took the initiative and came to his young nephew and said, well, look, the land is big enough for both of us. You go one direction, I'll go the other. But you choose first. And Lot lifted up his eyes in Genesis 13:10, and beheld all the plain of Jordan was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Even as the garden of the Lord, it was an Eden. The Jordan Valley was just like the Garden of Eden in the time of Abraham. Like the land of Egypt as you come to Zoar. And Lot chose all the plain of Jordan. Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves one from the other. And Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain and pitched his tent in the direction of Sodom. He made a little decision. The little, tiny, almost insignificant decision was what? Choosing first. The younger, not showing respect for the elder. You say, well, but Abraham said to choose first. And rather than showing deference and courtesy and respect, he went ahead and chose first. He said, okay, you big fat sucker. He didn't say it out loud. He may have thought it. I don't know what he thought. He chose first. He said, good grief, look at that beautiful, lush valley. There's no sense staying up here. And made a decision, a choice. What in the world is wrong with being in a valley? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Genesis 19, he's on the city council of Sodom. Verse 1. There came two angels, Genesis 19:1, to Sodom at evening. And Lot was sitting in the gate. The city council, the elders, the chief men of the city were those who sat in the gate. That's what that means. He was now a leading citizen in Sodom. And Lot saw these two men. He thought they were men. They were really angels. Rose up to meet them, bowed himself with his face toward the ground. He's in the gate. Now he's not just outside there in the valley. Now he's in the city. Now he's on the city council of Sodom. You know the story. The angel said, "We're coming here to destroy the city. Gather up your family and leave." In verse 14, Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who married his daughters, and said, "Up, get you out of this place. The Lord will destroy this city." But he seemed as one that mocked. "Oh, you're kidding. What kind of an idiotic joke." And they turned their back on their father-in-law. And Lot was forced to leave Sodom and his two daughters and their husband. He lost them because God rained down fire from heaven and utterly destroyed Sodom. Later on in verse 26, he loses his wife. His wife looked back from behind him in disobedience to God, and she became a pillar of salt. Now, that's never happened to me. I hope it never does. Or to you. But just stop and let your imagination for a brief moment reflect on what it would be like to be walking along with a human being, a person, and in one step turn, and this person is now a pillar of salt. That could get your attention. Your life partner, your companion, in a moment. And then the end of his life, he's living in incest. Drunkenness and incest. Verse 30, he went out of Zoar, dwelled in the mountain with his two daughters, the two younger, single daughters. And the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old. There's not a man in the earth to come in unto us after the manner of all the earth. Let us make our father drink wine and we'll lie with him." They made him drunk and committed sexual immorality and gave birth to the Moabites and to the Ammonites. Enemies to this day of Israel. Where did it all start? With the lack of respect toward his uncle. Two daughters were destroyed when the fire fell from heaven. His wife, a pillar of salt. In the close of his life, drunkenness and incest. To obey is better than sacrifice. Don't play the game, gang. Don't play the game. The decisions that you make this week in your race, in moving toward the objective, are going to be important decisions. You'll live with the consequences. You recall Moses? He smote the rock and the water came out. And the second time God said what? "Speak to the rock." But Moses lost his temper and smote the rock the second time. The Apostle Paul, writing to the Corinthians, said, "That rock was Christ. You only crucify Christ once. The next time you speak to Christ, you never crucify him twice." And because he smote the rock the second time, God said, "All right, Moses, you will not go into the promised land." And Moses starts to pray about it. "Lord, wouldn't you like to change your mind?" Deuteronomy chapter 3. And he starts out with this, you know, beautiful prayer, verses 23 through 26. You've begun to show your servant your greatness and power and so on. I pray thee, let me go over and see the good land that's beyond Jordan, that goodly mountain in Lebanon. And Moses tells the Israelite, but God was angry with me for your sakes, and God wouldn't hear me. And God said unto me, speak no more unto me of this matter. Speak no more. Don't bring up the subject, Moses. Don't pray about it. You're running. You're moving toward an objective. But every step is important. Make sure it's the right one. Now the second little expression here is run with patience. Let's go back to Hebrews 12:1. Patience. Let me read you a dictionary definition of patience. Calm and uncomplaining endurance under pain or provocation. Now, I'm sure all of us tonight could stand up and say we're very patient people. That our lives are characterized by calm, uncomplaining endurance under pain and provocation. Calmness in waiting. Quiet perseverance. You know what the Lord is looking for in you and me tonight? When he says run with patience, he's looking for some cross-country runners. He's not looking for some 100-yard dash men. Now the question is, have you made up your mind to run with patience? Lord, I want patience. And I want it right now. And gang, you know, we live in an era of instant everything. Instant breakfast, instant dinner, instant coffee, instant orange juice. Isn't that true? Our whole mood is instant. We want instant spirituality, instant victory, instant maturity, instant power, instant authority. And it's not to be had. No, it's run with patience, calmness in waiting. And there are some hard situations in the Bible. We talked about the Red Sea the other night, and the fact that, you know, God drowned the Egyptian army in 6 inches of water, facetiously. When did the Red Sea open for those million people? About 3 weeks before they needed it? No. The very night. Now, I don't know about you. I have never been responsible for a million men, women, and children. But that can be a burden if you're not careful. That is just a lot of people. You think of how many crying babies there were on the seashore? That's about how many there were who went out of Egypt. Now that is a bunch of folks. A million people. And on one side is this great body of water, the Red Sea. And coming up on the rear, the Egyptian army, chariots, bent on their destruction. And one man. Hello up there. When is it going to open? You know, and that night it opened. When did the Jordan River open? For Joshua and the children of Israel. 3 weeks in advance? No, here's a river in flood stage. And it's not until the priests bearing the ark get their size 9 right out over the water. And then all of a sudden the water goes down. They take a step and another step. And as they walk, the river comes in and dries up. And the whole nation crosses over in front of Jericho on dry ground. When? At the very last minute. Now, some of you have come to this conference and you're thinking about next week or next month. And why haven't I heard from those people? I wrote them in June. You don't need it yet. You don't need to know where you're going till you're on the way to the airport. It's like the Texan roared up to the airline counter and said, "Give me a ticket." And the guy said, "Where are you going?" He said, "It doesn't matter. I got business everywhere." Run with patience in the fullness of time. Jerry White talked about that yesterday morning. If you and I had planned it, Jesus would have been born in the Garden of Eden. But the Bible says in the fullness of time. Now, the Lord has a timetable for your life as well as a blueprint. It's a perfect timetable. Get your finger off of the panic button. You're sitting out there. "But I'm 19. I'll be an old maid. I haven't been out on a date in 3 hours. In the fullness of time. And anything of quality, anything that endures, anything that is permanent, anything that's worthwhile, takes time. Would you rather live in a house that was built in an afternoon or in 3 months? If you had a choice, probably the one that took 3 months to put together will last longer. You build with gold and silver and precious stones in the lives of people upon the foundation of Christ. What did Paul say in 2 Timothy 3:10? We quoted that the other night. "Thou hast fully known my doctrine." Pardon me? "Thou hast fully known my doctrine." Who said that? Paul. Fully known Paul's doctrine? He wrote Romans, Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, the pastoral epistles. And he's got the nerve to write to Timothy and said, "You fully know my doctrine. You fully know my manner of life," because you can't separate doctrine from life. They're inseparable. "You fully know my purpose. You fully know my faith. Long-suffering, patience, persecutions, afflictions." What right did Paul have to say that to Timothy? He spent 14 years with Timothy. From the time he met him in Acts 16 till the time he wrote that letter. Time. Paul ran the race patient. Are you playing the game for the fourth quarter?
You have to pace yourself.
If you plan to win, you'll have to play a strong game in the fourth quarter. But if you pour all of your energy and all of your zeal and all of your activity and burn out now, then what? Run the race with patience. Perspective, God's point of view. And don't be in a hurry. You bring forth fruit in your season. Let's think for a moment about the race that is set before us. Run with patience the race that is set before us. What does this race mean? Well, let me read you some definitions from the dictionary of a race. It's a course of life. The course of life. Circumstances. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm probably one of the most patient, understanding people you'll ever meet. There are really only two things that bother me. Two little things that bother me. People and circumstances. How about you? And we're involved. We don't have any choice. The well-known Hollywood personality, Edward G. Robinson, a few years ago, made an interesting comment. He said, "Life is not a spectator sport." Now, football is, you know. Someone has defined a football game as 22 men desperately needing rest, surrounded by 40,000 people desperately needing exercise. And you know that's true. There are a lot of sports that we're spectators. But life is not a spectator sport. We are in the race course. We're involved. There is a stream. There's flow. There's action. There's direction. There are obstacles. There are entanglements. I've still got a couple of blood blisters in my hand. Last Tuesday, a week ago, I was up at Eagle Lake, spending a few days with the family, vacation, spending time in the Word, fishing with the kids and so on. And the trail camp counselors up there have built an obstacle course. They call it a confidence course. They lied about it. And the first thing they did, there's a log up a tree, you know, from the ground up to about, 6 feet, you know. And so you walk up this log, you know. And then you get up on a cable. The cable starts at about 6 feet and goes to another tree about 40 feet away. And out over a canyon, you're about 30 feet in the air. And there are a couple of little thin ropes. And so you walk on this cable out there, and then you get up on a higher cable and you go to another tree. And then they've got a log tied between two trees and some swings hanging down, different heights. And you have to go from one swing to the next swing, and it's about 40 feet straight down to the ground. You know, it's about like up to that ceiling. I didn't enjoy it.
I was almost bitter over the whole thing.
Then they've got another log up there with a rope, and you hang on the rope and you walk across the log. And then finally they've got a rope, you go all the way down, you know, a long stretched out rope, and you get on this rope and you just slide down, bang. Then you get another rope and you climb up the side of a cliff. And then the last thing is about 100 yards long, and it's a cable with a pulley. And you stand on the edge of this cliff, and it's 50 feet high down there. You hang on, you know, and then you jump, and this pulley goes, bang, 100 yards later into the ground. A confidence course. Oh. The question is, in life, who set the race? It is said, the race that is set before us. And you'll have to come to your own conclusion. But if you believe that God is who He claims to be, you will come to the conclusion that God is in control of your life. God is in control of the circumstances surrounding your life. God is in control of all the events which come into your life. It is the race, it is the course, with its obstacles and with its problems and with its pitfalls, the race that is set before us. And the life of faith simply means accepting that challenge, moving ahead, your eyes on Jesus Christ. Do you remember the story of Joseph, the young man who was sold into slavery by his brothers in Genesis? And there's a wonderful verse at the close of Genesis, because you know the story. The kid brother, all the older brothers, he was kind of the favorite of his father, and they were jealous, and he had a kind of a rotten attitude, and told his brothers about his dreams. They said, well, we'll show this dreamer. And some of them were going to kill him, and a couple of them said, no, let's not kill him. Let's just be real kind. Let's sell him into slavery. And they sold him into slavery, and he was carried off to Egypt. And he rose to a position of prominence until the wife of his employer wanted him to commit adultery with her. And then because he refused to commit sin with this woman, she lied about him, she framed him, and he was thrown in prison by the Egyptian official for whom he worked. And he spent 7 years in an Egyptian prison. And then God brought him out and made him second in command, the prime minister of the nation. And in verse 20 of Genesis 50, after he reveals himself to his brothers, and there's this giant reunion and tears and all the rest, he said, as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it for good. You intended to do me harm, but in spite of the fact that you sold me into slavery, in spite of the fact that I had to spend 7 years in prison, accused unjustly by an immoral woman, in spite of all I've been through, God meant it for good. How about your heart tonight? Is there any bitterness? Resentment? Ill will? Is there some feeling towards some other person? That person has tried to harm me. That person has tried to do me in. That person has lied about me. That person has misrepresented me or maligned me or defamed my character. That person has treated me unfairly, unjustly. That's not even the question tonight. The question is, what about your heart? But I was passed over. I should have had that position. I should have had that responsibility. I should have had that raise. Promotion cometh what? Neither from the east, nor the west, nor the south. God is the judge. He puts up one, and He sets down another. Psalm 75, 6 and 7. And don't miss it, gang. God is the judge. And you are where you are tonight because God wants you right where you are. You may have the feeling that you're in prison, that you're trapped. So was Joseph. That you've been treated unfairly. As soon as you're finished with the TMS, memorize Hebrews 12, 14 and 15. Follow peace with all men, and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord, looking diligently lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you. And thereby many be defiled. Several years ago, Mr. Sanney, the president of the Navigators, made a comment that just hit me like a bolt right between the eyes. Lauren has walked with God for many, many years. Been with the Navigators 31 years. Been around the world. A great man of God. Man of the Word, a man of faith. And he said, you know, bitterness has taken more people out of the ministry than immorality. And I thought, boy, I knew that immorality was bad. Bitterness has been the cause for more people being removed from the work of Christ. Bitterness. The next chapter, verse 6, Hebrews 13, 6. The Lord is my helper. I will not fear what man shall do unto me. The race that is set before you. God may use men. Your parents. The dean. Some faculty member. Your employer. In the military, it's your commanding officer. Certainly God uses men, people, to control and influence your life. But behind it all, God is in charge. The race that is set before you has been set by God. And if you'll believe that and accept it, and keep your heart and run your race with patience, with your eyes upon Jesus, you're walking by faith. Walking by faith isn't some, you know, cloudy, dreamy sort of a thing. Blue skies, white clouds, and blowing flowers in the field. No, sometimes the race that is set before you is going to be a storm. Can you imagine what it was like in that little boat with the water coming in And it's midnight. It is pitch black. In a howling storm and a sinking ship. And Jesus asleep in the stern on a pillow. And they wake him up. Carest thou not that we perish? That we what? We are going to drown. Drown. What do you think about drowning? Well, okay, fellas. Peace. Be still. There was a great calm. And he said, you weren't paying attention. I didn't say, let us go out in the middle and drown. I said, let us go to the other side. You weren't listening. Where is your faith? The race that is set before you sometimes may include a howling storm. A sinking ship. It may include the Red Sea and the Egyptian army, or the equivalent. Don't resent all of those circumstances and pressures. Run with patience, with your eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of your faith.